Hello and welcome to Creative Instinct on RN, RA and the web. I'm Michael Sheritz. Now, it used to be that you had to go all the way to an arcade to play a video game. If you were a kid, you had to beg your parents to drive you there or make a stop on the way home from school. And even if you pulled that off, there were never enough coins to play as much as you wanted. Well, the world of video games has changed quite a bit since then. Not only can we play at home on flat-screen TVs, we can also carry them around in the palm of our hand. The mobile video game has been shaking up the industry for quite a few years now. Queensland, for a time, was a vibrant hub of well-supported games developers and the go-to place for many of the big international games companies. But economic and technology changes caused the bottom to fall out of that a bit and the community fragmented somewhat. So this is the story about what that's meant for game developers in Brisbane as producer Michael Rhee steps into the world of the indies.
Jason Stark loved games as a kid. Not just video games, all games. And he didn't just like playing them. He made them.
I was always organizing crazy games for us to play, and we were playing Frogger in the backyard. So I'd have people who would we grabbed washing trolleys that you hold up washing. So I had the kids pushing them, and one person was the frog, and they had to jump between them. And for all my life, that's what I've done. I was always the guy coming up with things like that and making these made-up scenarios.
As Jason got older, this habit didn't go away. It got stronger. Here's his wife, Nicole, talking about how they used to make board games at home.
We used to spend hours cutting little cardboard cutouts out. There was one where you could either be a monster or you could be a little girl.
Oh, the little girl one. Yeah, yeah.
It
was Monster Hunter.
We made it for my niece.
Yeah, Monster
Hunter.
And
she always picked to be the monster, not the little girl.
We sent them off to a few, the only Australian board game company that we could find, and they sent back months later a very polite letter saying, sorry, there's no market for board games in Australia.
It's only really been now that you could make something that incorporated a game and a story.
Streets of their neighborhoods, it will be bad for business.
Well, what are we gonna do, Sonny?
We treat him like an old friend and keep him busy out of town, okay?
Presley!
Kinetic barriers down.
Multiple hull breaches. Weapons offline. Somebody get that fire out.
I love games because you can do all the things you can't do in real life in a game, so you can go and you can blow up things that you can't really do, or you can paint objects or do whatever, like, out of this world. Things you wish you could do, but you can't actually do physically in real life.
Well, me personally, it's the way it takes you into another world. I love stories, so being able to interact with the story like the way you do in a game is really awesome to me.
This is the Mana Bar in Brisbane. About once a month, they have a game developers night here for people like Jess Dutaler and Jess Hayward. They're here to see what other developers like themselves are up to.
Everyone I've met that's in the games industry is so nice and friendly and really welcoming, and everyone's really supportive, especially in Brisbane. We're a really supportive community, so it's nice to be part of that.
This independent community only sprang up recently. It happened out of necessity, really. Just a few years ago, Brisbane was a kind of gaming capital. There were video game developers here that employed hundreds of people and had multi-million dollar budgets. Jason was there at the very beginning, in the mid-1990s, when he started working at a place called Chrome.
It was a very, very, very small company then. There were only a few people. There was exposed wiring in the walls. The files were being passed around the office via floppy disk because we didn't have a network up and running yet. Nicole worked there for...
Yeah, I worked there for about 6 years. Me and this other girl were the first girls to work there, which was a bit of a culture shock for some of the guys. They had to take the porn drive down.
Yes, there was a porn drive at the beginning.
Excuse me, miss. Didn't you used to be the ship's librarian?
I still am. So, is that a library book in your pocket? Or are you just glad to see me?
But once the guys got over that, they were very welcoming. It was, had a lovely vibe.
And then the company grew at a phenomenal rate, and it was, you know, just fantastic good times. We had Christmas parties where we'd be at Wet n Wild, and there was lots of money coming in, and that was great. And then it fragmented into smaller teams. A lot of the teams developed cultures that were very separate from each other, which was very strange. You're almost like a city within a greater country. And towards the end, when the company went down, I realized I didn't know most of the people that worked there. We'd gotten to that size where we were 300-400 people, and I really only knew about 50 of them.
I think I got rid of all my T-shirts. These are the games we worked on. That's Sparkling Ice Show, Bali. Championship Surfer, that was the first thing that I ever worked on. Yeah. Sunny Garcia, both Nicole and I worked on that. What else we got? We've got a lot of rubbish here. There's something from BDE, there's another Sunny Garcia. Oh, Goofy Skateboarding! But it's funny, we don't have anything Chrome specific. We did have the hoodies, and when Chrome collapsed, I quite deliberately chucked mine away.
It was a bit sad.
It just didn't, it didn't seem appropriate wearing the Chrome hoodie. It was weird. It was almost like a mourning process when the whole thing finally collapsed and was gone.
And these were people who had stable jobs, mortgages, you know, kids and...
Like you guys.
Well, yeah, like us.
Yeah, like us. Yeah, yeah. It was quite a shock. I mean, a lot of people started the industry in the time where it was a stable job, and they'd had a stable job for a decade, a full decade, with houses and kids in the same school. And, yeah, to have that all disappear, it was... I really can't emphasize just how brutal it was for so many lives.
It was heartbreaking. It was absolutely heartbreaking because you become a family. We were doing 16-hour days for 4 weeks, and to have it all just taken away.
That's developer Megan Summers. This is Robert Reed.
You basically get the rug pulled out from under you. You've got no footing at all because you kind of see it coming, but you never expect it. So when it does eventually happen, you kind of just have to think, well, what do I want to do now?
The industry changed.
Games started moving onto mobile devices and smartphones. People ate them up. They were easy, fun, and at the most, a few dollars. It changed the business. And that meant companies like Chrome weren't relevant anymore.
We really made a living making solid B titles. So I did a lot of movie licenses. Like Happy Feet 2 was the last game I did, the video game. And really, that sort of game doesn't exist anymore. Either it's a cheap mobile app, which you buy for a dollar or is free, or it's a AAA awesome experience. And so that middle ground, which we were occupying so firmly, just evaporated. And along with the high Australian dollar, there just wasn't any reason for us to exist. And all our American partners just stopped giving us jobs, really. It just slowly over time fell apart. The money dried up. And it was pretty sad times.
But there was an upside to the crash. And it was in those same games that completely upended the industry. People were downloading these games tens of millions of times. And the cost of licensing and distributing a mobile game all over the world was a fraction of what it used to be. For Jason and Nicole, that meant it was the perfect time to take a chance.
It was always our dream to go indie, and so the collapse of the local industry was just a great big push. I mean, once it was gone, we desperately wanted it to survive, of course, and we were really hoping that that stable job could be there forever, but once it did crash, it was kind of liberating. It was like the worst thing that we could imagine had happened, so we were forced to go it alone.
The Starks moved with their four daughters out of Brisbane to Noosa. They had always dreamed of living by the beach. All they needed now was a great idea for a game.
We were going to make a very worthy game.
Yeah, it was going to be an RPG. It was going to be a sci-fi.
Sci-fi noir, yeah, cyberpunk sort of thing.
Yeah. It's going to be an exploration of dreams and failure.
Yeah, it was good.
And then we went, no, let's not do this. Let's do something quick and easy. And my eldest daughter had this crazy idea.
For some reason, she had to discuss the pros and cons of gastric bypass surgery.
Oh, yeah. So it was governmental responses to obesity. And she said she came up with a plan that was far cheaper and very effective and would have results almost immediately.
Yeah, like setting tires in the street to chase all the fat people.
Alia Stark.
I figured, you know, people have lost all their natural predators, and that's why you were able to eat so much and become unfit. So I thought, well, let's introduce natural selection back to the population. Not seriously, obviously. I was just joking around, but that's more or less where it came from.
And I was talking to my brother-in-laws and my brother. We were having a bucks party, and I just told them that idea, and they all laughed, and they said, I'd play that video game. And I hadn't thought of it as a video game until then, and that was like the genesis of it. We go, oh, wow, that does make a sort of a funny, catchy video game.
What I love about games is the ability to take your ideas and really put them onto an open media very quickly. You can take everything that's in your brain that you want to be out there and put it out there and make it happen.
It's like making a film, but it's interactive. It's somebody else can go in and change your world, and you've got to think about everything that somebody else might do in a world that you've created, and it just opens a world of possibilities.
For Jason, starting work on a game begins with one important thing: the story.
The first words of the game are, "This is Bert." You don't get to see a lot of his history in the game, but we made up history for ourselves. So we know he's Bert. He's in middle management. He's got kids. He's a good father, you know. And it's not like he's lazy or he's a pig or anything. It's just he's never had time to prioritize, you know, health and fitness. So he's just let himself go over the years. And, you know, one lunchtime he decided to go for a quiet walk. And that was the morning the government decided to let tigers loose onto the streets. Now, the first stage of doing a project is the rough prototype, where you just prove out the basic concepts. So Bert was just a capsule, and the buildings were boxes, and the tiger was a box. And so I'd just code in the basic functionality there. Now, Nicole would come along and replace my ugly boxes and whatnot with pretty things.
Then when the art was finished, I had to draw the sound.
Yeah, I'll throw it on this background. Levels are the things that are probably the easiest thing to show, because they are quite literally a level. And I can go into it here. But if I wanted to put a chair in the path of Bert to make the game a little bit more interesting, I would quite literally just grab that chair, select it, put it there. I can duplicate it. Here's some objects that Nicole made. There you go. Boink. There you go. There's our coffee stand. So there you go. So she'd actually make this and then UV map it and then paint the textures in Photoshop. And there you go. You've got a coffee stand, which I can then throw into the game.
Then you give it physics properties.
Yeah, that's true.
If you want it to have effects, you give it effects.
Yeah, particles and everything.
If you want it to play sounds when Bert runs into it, then you attach them to it in here.
A code is the most mysterious thing to explain to someone who doesn't know what code is. I mean, it is quite literally words in a text file. That's all it is. But it's the instructions for doing the game. So it does everything. It tells Bert what animation to play when he's running. It tells Bert how fast he runs. It's the brains of everything.
There are so many other people who are also trying to get their game out there and already so many games already made, like, what are you bringing to the table that's going to make yours worth putting out there, you know?
The first game I worked on never got released. The second game I worked on never got released. And it becomes your life. It really does, especially during crunch time, especially during those last few months of a project.
One of the hardest things we've experienced is like actually like creating out of like a prototype of our game and then having other people play it, and that's a hard process because you go through, you know, weeks and weeks of going along thinking this is the best design you can have, and then a group of people that are testing it for you come along and say we don't get it, and you're like, how do you not get it? Like, it's so frustrating to sit there and go, just click the button, you know, that's how you do it, and they just don't see it, and you can't tell them that.
There is a game out there for anything you love. It's pretty much been made by now. I don't think there's many genres that haven't been made into games.
In July, Jason and Nicole finally released their first game, Run Fatty Run. This quick and easy project they thought would take 6 weeks ended up taking 18 months to complete. But the hard part was over, or so they thought.
We were pretty optimistic, so we were getting ready for the money to roll in. And then when the game released, it didn't really sell at all, and it didn't really earn us any money at all. It didn't even pay for the cost of the software licenses. It shattered our self-confidence. That was the thing that hurt the most.
The worst was not knowing whether we were good enough to make a, like, we thought we'd made a pretty good game that people seemed to enjoy, having that undermined.
There's an early Simpsons where I think Homer sticks them all in an RV and drives them off somewhere, and he thinks he's lost, but he just walks away from the whole family just to quietly cry so they can't see him break down, and he cries out, "Oh my God, I've murdered us all." And the echoes boom around. And that's what I felt like. I felt like, oh my God, I've murdered us all.
What am I going to do? I've murdered us all. I've murdered us all. I've murdered us all.
And I love my pillow, Janelle, I must say, sharing that with you. And the
was it Congress in Italy and Ditivarine?
He's taught a culture writer when he bought the Pioneer.
Right, Darren, not every family bonds over games, but the Stark family in Queensland are all gamers.
We weren't really thinking of it much because we'd had a few appearances in the press, and, you know, we kept waiting for things to spark something, and nothing sparked anything. So you go, okay, whatever. And then I think you mentioned, oh, we'll be on TV this weekend. And you go, oh, yeah, all right, we get to be on TV.
Making the game has been a very long process, a surprisingly long process. One of the reasons why we did this idea was we thought it would be very simple, very short, and very quick. And that's not true at all.
And we watched this on TV, and it was a really nice special they did on us. It was quite a few minutes long. It was focused on the whole family, and it was a really nice piece. So you go, oh, yeah. And we're just going to bed, and I remember thinking, oh, I should check the charts. Maybe we'll actually be in the charts again. Maybe we'll be in the hundreds, because we got very excited when we were in the top 100. We go, oh, I'll just look.
In fact, the Starks had almost broken the top 10. Over the next few weeks, the game kept climbing up the rankings until it became the number one paid iPad app in Australia. Jason and Nicole say the best part of this is that the game was entirely their own. There was no marketing executive or corporate officer telling them what to do, or that a game about tigers chasing fat people was stupid, offensive, or wouldn't sell. They had none of that. This game was all them.
It is what we've always wanted to do. We wanted to make our own thing. And it's terrifying, but at the same time, it's wonderful to have finally done that and to get it out there to so many people who are actually enjoying something that came from us. Especially the fact that the whole family contributed to it. It's been amazing just to have something that's so us.
We did it because we had to. I mean, it's what we'd been burning to do for the past 20 years. And we'd been buckling under the pressure of being sensible all those years, really. And it was wonderful to finally get a chance to do what we want to do and be independent. I think all the creatives, I reckon about 90% of people in the games industry have the same drive. They all want to make their ideas. I mean, you don't join the games industry so you can do walk animations for the rest of your life. You have a vision and you have ideas and you want to share it with the world. And we finally got a chance to do it, so we took it. And we're going to keep taking it for as long as we possibly can.
We're creating old-school point-and-click adventure games. We grew up with games like Day of the Tentacle, Sam & Max, Full Throttle, The Dig, you know, all those type of games. Those were the games that we really loved back in the day. So we just thought we'd make one of our own.
What happens is the character, Leo, he's lost all the colour in his world, and he needs to find out what happened to it, and how he does that is he navigates the environment by painting things.
Well, imagine it's WoW, the World of Warcraft, but everything is done through writing. So when you walk into a room, you have to read what the room looks like. If you want to attack a monster, you have to actually type, you know, kill goblin.
That's Matthew Ford, a local game developer and teacher.
I think that Brisbane has got a huge future for independent games. Even though the big studios melt down, I think it's a great time to be here. A great time to be making games in Brisbane, definitely.
It's so funny, my brother's a carpenter, so he does things that are very real. He builds buildings, and these guys think what he does is amazing. They think he's a Superman. But his kids were visiting us, and I was just doing some work, and they're like, look at the screen.
Mommy, look at this.
Did you make that box? And I go, yeah, I made that box. Wow. So his kids think I'm a Superman, and my kids think he's a Superman. Because we both do things that the other dad just can't do.
What? Do you want some food?
I'm surprised they managed to pull it off in the first place.
Jason and Nicole's second oldest daughter, Raven.
But it is very strange to have these home-working parents who make small iPhone games for a living, and that will be your life from here on now. It makes me wonder about what my future will bring.
One of the biggest surprises for Jason through all this has been the effect it's had on his kids. He says they've never been happier.
Yeah, technically we did the irresponsible thing. Yeah. It certainly felt irresponsible at the time. And people go, oh, you know, how could you do that with your kids? But it has been the absolute best decision for our kids. They get their parents around a lot more. They get happier parents because we're doing what we love. Mm-hmm. And it just works out so much better. I mean, we can schedule our lives around their lives. So if they have some mission critical event on at school, we can make it. We can always be there for them. So, you know, we can be much better parents than we ever were. And even though we've got less money coming in, from a child's point of view, money is actually the least important thing you can offer them. The best thing you can give them is your time and your attention, and that's what they've been getting.
Jason also learned something else. He and Nicole had their first child when they were 19. Jason figured, like a lot of people do, that was the end for his big dreams. But something interesting happened, something he never expected.
It turned out that our children were what made us. They're what made us unique. It's why we got any press at all. And they do so much to shape our ideas, that our ideas wouldn't be as good or as interesting or as different if we hadn't had them. So the life that we led, which I thought, you know, was kind of destroying our dreams, ended up making them possible. Yeah, made them happen. So it was just really neat how that happened.
Jason and Nicole are already hard at work on their next game, about a girl ninja who delivers pizza.
Michael Ree, detecting serious signs of life amongst game developers in Queensland. And a very special thanks to the Brisbane Indie Game Developers Community. For more information, please visit our website, abc.net.au. cbc.com.au/Radio National and follow the links to Creative Instinct. Many thanks to John Jacobs for his technical production. I'm Michael Sheriffs. Join me again next week.
What do Bette Midler, Peter Ustinov, Muhammad Ali and Orson Welles have in common? Well, all have been interviewed by Michael Parkinson, the Yorkshireman described as the great British talk show host. Over the years, he's had hundreds of guests. So, who was his favourite? Which interviews, looking back, does he see as the best? If you missed Sunday Profile and we didn't have the internet, you'd never know. But we do. So just go to abc.net.au/Radio National.